Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Men and women. His story has been told in the book Schindler's Ark and, of course, in the Steven Spielberg movie Schindler's List. Selena Karp-Biniaz's name was on that list, along with the names of her parents, Irvin and Phyllis Karp. The family was forced into the Jewish ghetto in Krakow, Poland, and later a forced labor camp, and Selena and her mother were even transferred to Auschwitz before Oskar Schindler intervened to take them to his factory in Czechoslovakia. After the war, the family came to Iowa, and Selena Biniaz is in Iowa this week sharing her story as a guest of the Iowa Jewish Historical Society. She's on the phone with me now. Selena, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
I want to go back to your early life in Krakow, Poland. Tell me about what you remember about that time.
Well, the Germans invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939. I had just finished, prior to that, second grade. I was 8 years old. And as soon as the Germans came, they closed all the schools, so there was no chance to go on to third grade. And the interesting thing is that just prior to the invasion, we lived in an apartment building that had like three sections to it with a courtyard in between. And some of the men would gather and talk politics and talk about what's going to happen, you know. Interestingly enough, on 1st of September, some of the very same men who were discussing politics with my father and other people came down with armbands with swastikas on them. So you can imagine, at that very point, people begin to think, you can't trust anybody.
So friends and neighbors are the ones that forced your family into the ghetto.
That's right. It was our neighbors, people with, you know, whose children I was playing with, you know.
Right. You lived in the ghetto for what?
No, I did not.
Oh, you didn't. Okay.
We lived in an area of Krakow that was very, very middle class, very mixed. There were maybe a couple other Jewish families in the complex where we lived, but otherwise, no, mostly Christians.
Right.
So, and I went, of course, to public school, which in Poland was, in Poland, Catholicism is a national religion. So even the schools, in each school, there was a crucifix hanging in the classroom. And we as children were taught good manners. It didn't matter what religion you were, but if you saw a priest or a nun on the street, you curtsied. That was just good manners. So, you know, so the war was really a shock. So
right.
What happened, just weren't expecting it.
Right. So,
it's certainly not from an 8-year-old's point of view. You know?
Oh, sure. So when your family was forced into the ghetto, being a middle-class family, losing your home, did you lose all of your belongings at that time?
Well, it was very fortunate that, fortunate or unfortunate, but anyway, we had some time. There was like several weeks, almost a couple months before we were forced into the ghetto. And my mother was able to talk to some of the neighbors and able to sell some of the furniture, silver, china. So that actually when we finally ended up in the ghetto in one room, we didn't have that much to bring with us, you know.
You lived in the ghetto for 5 years?
No. Lived in the ghetto for about 2.5 years. Then the ghetto was liquidated, and we were transferred to a concentration camp on the outskirts of Krakow that was built on the cemetery, on the Jewish cemeteries. And we were, you know, forced labor at that concentration camp. That's what's featured in Schindler's List. That camp and the commandant is featured in the movie.
What was life like for you as a child in the ghetto?
Well, my parents were both accountants, and so they were able to, to go out of the ghetto and continue their jobs, because one of the places that my father worked for, which was a sewing factory, was taken over by a Viennese man, given spoils of war, and it became a sewing factory, continued to be a sewing factory, but made uniforms for the army, for the German army. And then my father did all the accounting and ran the factory for this man. So they were allowed to leave the ghetto to go to work. I, however, being only I was 9, 10 at that point, because we were in the ghetto for about 2 years, a little more than 2 years. At first, we children, the few that were there, were taken to a cooperative where we worked, making envelopes, putting together and licking envelopes together. That was one type of work for children. Another type of work was a brush factory, where we inserted some of the bristles into pre-drilled pieces of wood, and tighten it with a wire. So that was another type of work that we performed. But as more and more, as the ghetto got smaller and smaller because of liquidations, my parents got very upset and worried by leaving me alone in the ghetto while they were going out. So they bribed some, I don't know who, to make my age 2 years older. So at 12, I was given a blue card, which allowed me to leave the ghetto with them. So I left the ghetto at that point, and traveled with my parents to this sewing factory, and I started working on a sewing machine.
And that saved your life, because most of the children in the ghetto were killed, right?
Absolutely. When the ghetto was finally liquidated, it was horrible, absolutely horrible.
What do you remember about that time?
Well, I remember seeing the brutality, and if I tell you, you won't believe it. None of your audience would believe it, but some of the German soldiers would pick up babies and smash their heads against the walls. It was just awful. It was really at that point that Oskar Schindler, who witnessed this from a kind of a overhang, not a mountain, but a higher hill overhang that he could look into the ghetto, saw this carnage going on. And that's at that point he had an epiphany and decided he was going to save some of his workers that were working at his factory, which was an enamel works factory. So
once the ghetto was liquidated, tell me about where your family went next.
We went to Prachov concentration camp, and the sewing factory was moved into the camp and set up in barracks. We continued making uniforms for the German army, and Mr. Modrich was an excellent human being, really. He cared about his workers, not only that, but he really was ashamed of what was going on. He was so good that under those huge bolts of fabric that were coming into the camp, to the sewing factory for the uniforms, he would bring in extra loaves of bread, medications, things like that, that really helped his workers. As a matter of fact, Mr. Modrich has been honored by the Israeli Holocaust Museum, Yad Vashem, for his contribution in saving and helping the Jews during the war.
I'm talking to Selena Karp-Binias. She is in Iowa this week. She's sharing her story as a Holocaust survivor and one of the last people still living whose name appeared on Oscar Schindler's list, a list that saved her life and the lives of at least 1,200 other Jewish men and women. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Selena Karp-Binias. She's in Iowa this week as a guest of the Iowa Jewish Historical Society, and she's sharing her story as a survivor of the Holocaust. She lived in Krakow, Poland as a young girl and then was forced into the Jewish ghetto there. Her family then was forced into a concentration camp, a work camp, and she and her mother were actually transferred to Auschwitz before Oskar Schindler intervened to take them to his factory in Czechoslovakia. After the war, the family emigrated to Iowa. And we were just before the break talking about that labor camp. And again, another moment in this horrific story that saved your life and the lives of your parents, that you were the recipients of kindness, that the man who ran the factory you were working in did help get food for some of the workers who were working at the factory. You were pretending to be 2 years older than you were so that you could work and stay alive. What was your daily life like in that labor camp?
Well, daily life started with early morning, a wake-up call. We all had to appear in front of the barracks, stand in groups of five, rows of five, and be counted. That was the first thing that happened. After the count, which usually took at least an hour in the cold, then we were allowed to have our breakfast, which was just a slice of bread and a cup, you know, watered-down chicory coffee kind of thing. And then we were marched in groups of five again down from our sleeping barracks over to the area where the factory was located behind another barbed wire. So, and then there we worked all day. We had lunch made by some of the workers. And then again in the afternoon, when we were finished, we went back to our barracks. Again, we were counted on, you know, to make sure that nobody escaped. And we were given some soup and another slice of bread. And that was the day. And that, you know, then we went into our barracks and lights were out. And that was that. That was the day.
As a young girl living in these circumstances, did you fear for your life? Did you think about the future?
We always feared for our lives because the commandant of that camp was really I would say he was a sociopath. He enjoyed killing people with his revolver just if you looked at him. So none of us dared to, you know, look him in the eyes or anything. We always passed him with our heads down. There was fear all the time, you know. But as long as we were in the barracks under the protection of the people that employed us, that part of it was fairly safe. When we left the employment, I mean, in other words, in the evening or before we went to the factory in the morning, we were then subject to the commandant, and he could do anything he wanted with us. So there was incredible fear all the time.
Were you with your mother in the barracks?
Yes. The women were separated from the men, but I was always with my mother and the other women that worked at the factory.
Were there any other girls as young as you were?
Just a little. There were some, but they were, you know, like 15, 16. I was always the youngest somehow. Fortunately, I was as tall then as I am now, so you couldn't pick me out from a group of, in the row of five, you know. I did not stand down. I mean, in other words, I was not the shortest or anything like that, so I blended in. So they couldn't really tell that I was as young as I was.
Right. And it sounds like you did anything you could do to not draw attention to yourself, like all of you were trying.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How long were you at that forced labor camp?
Okay. That forced labor camp started to dissolve in 1944, I would say in September, October, because there were posted notices of liquidation, because the Russians were then coming closer to that area. They were conquering parts of Poland and moving the German army back west, you know. So we were told that the camp was going to be liquidated. It was at that point that Oskar Schindler, who had his factory there, decided to take some of his workers to start another munitions factory in Czechoslovakia and take some of his workers there. He was a very good friend of Modrić, and so he asked Modrić if Modrić wouldn't want to join him and move his factory also to Czechoslovakia. But Modrić decided he's had enough of all of this, and he said no, he was going to go back to Vienna. So Oskar Schindler said to him, well, I'm making up a little, because he bribed the commandant and got permission to take 1,100 people to the munitions factory in Czechoslovakia. He said to Modrić, all right, give me some of your people and I'll put them on the list, which is what Modrić did. And that's how my family, because my parents worked so closely with him, you know, in running the factory and keeping the accounts, et cetera, we were put on the list. And that's how we ended up in Schindler's factory in Czechoslovakia.
Although before...
I happened to be the youngest female on the list. And Schindler was actually asked by some of the Germans policing that, why do you want young people? And he said he needed the young people because we had these small hands that could go up into the machinery to clean it. And this is exactly what I was doing when I was at Schindler's factory. I cleaned the machinery.
You were placed on that list. You were eventually sent to Czechoslovakia to work in that factory. But before that happened, you were sent to Auschwitz.
A lot of tragedy, yes, exactly. Well, see, what happened, so around beginning, end of September, beginning of October, the 800 men who were on the list were put into the boxcars and left for the factory in Czechoslovakia. After they left, and my father was one of them, we had no idea what happened to them because, of course, there was no mail or anything like that. We really didn't know whether they made it, whether they ended up in a concentration camp, or whether they were actually going to the munitions factory. 2 weeks later, the 300 women were placed in boxcars, and, the boxcars were sealed, and we were in the boxcars for about a day and a half, and it was in the middle of the night when all of a sudden we heard the crunching of the train and stopping, and we were pretty sure that because it was, day and a half, we figured we were already in Czechoslovakia. But when the doors opened, we found ourselves in Auschwitz, which was an unbelievable shock. somehow something happened, and the 300 women ended up in Auschwitz.
Did you know what Auschwitz was?
Well, by the end of 1944, we had heard, you know, we knew that it was an extermination camp. We knew that, you know, that it was not a good idea to end up in Auschwitz. That was for sure. And we could see it right away. I mean, there were plumes of fire illuminating the sky, the night sky. There were dogs barking, shouting by the German soldiers, trying to get us all out of the boxcars and turned into a line, you know. So we kind of knew, and right away we were walked into another barrack that had a sign that said sauna, and sauna in German means bathhouse. And we were walked into that barrack, told to strip, completely told we were naked, leave our clothing and everything else behind. Then the women who were barbering there cut our hair, some of it completely to some people, some of it just bits and pieces here and there. So we all looked like scarecrows. And then we were marched into our shower, you know, and the door was closed, and we could all look up and see that there were outlets, you know. We were only hoping, you know, we were wondering, are we going to get the gas or are we going to get showers? Fortunately, so that was a moment of incredible fear, you know.
You just stood there waiting to die.
That's right. And you can't imagine the relief, even though we were in Auschwitz, the relief when the water finally came down and we were, you know, wetted down, and then we were led through another door to another barrack where we were given wooden shoes and different clothing. So none of us got the same clothing we came in with. And then we were separated into groups of 100, because there were 300 of us, into three barracks. And we stayed in these three barracks for about between 5 and 6 weeks. And we have all kinds of chores to do during. First of all, we were always counted again, but this time we stood on the counting place for about 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours at lunchtime, and 2 hours in the evening. And at this point, it is already November, and it's cold, very cold and snowy in Poland. At the, you know, so we cleaned the barracks, we cleaned the latrines. Those were our jobs. Clean the snow.
And actually came face-to-face with Dr. Joseph Mengele when you were there, right?
Yes, I did.
Tell me what happened.
Well, every so often they would go in and take a group of women to take them to the kitchen to help clean potatoes, you know, to peel potatoes, kitchen duty. That particular day, they wanted 30 women. My mother, we've always been together. My mother volunteered to go with the group to peel potatoes. As she said later, it was the question of maybe she could pick up a few extra pieces and hide them mm-hmm. and bring them so we could eat them. As soon as that group left, we were commandeered outside and taken to another barrack, walked to another barrack, and told to strip and lined up all naked and in front of Dr. Mengele, who had a pencil in his hand, and the pencil to the left meant you're no good. The pencil to the right meant okay, you can still live. And I came face to face with him. My body was complete, you know, I was underdeveloped, skinny, but fortunately my body was clean. It didn't have any marks on it or anything like that. At first, the first time we went through, he pushed me to the left. But then after he went through the whole group, he had a change of heart and asked the people who were in the left group to come again. And this time, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know what prompted me to say to him in German three words that, Lassen Sie mich, which means let me go. He looked at me, and the pencil went to the right. And believe me, I ran. I picked up my clothes and crying hysterically, really, because at that point my emotions were at the very top. I ran out naked into the snow.
Selena Karp-Binias is in Iowa this week. She's sharing her story. She is a Holocaust survivor. She's a guest of the Iowa Jewish Historical Society. She survived the Holocaust because her name was on the list of Oskar Schindler, a German industrialist and member of the Nazi Party who saved more than 1,200 Jewish men and women. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Selena Karp-Binias. She's in Iowa this week. She's sharing her story of surviving the Holocaust. She is a guest of the Iowa Jewish Historical Society. And when she survived the Holocaust, she and her family ended up immigrating to the United States and living in Des Moines, where she graduated from North High School. She went to Grinnell College and, of course, is returning to Iowa to share her story this week. And just before the break, Selena, we were talking about your encounter with Dr. Joseph Mengele, who somehow granted you a reprieve, did not murder you, as so many others who were next to you, who were near you, were murdered. You were in Auschwitz, you said, for what, 6 or 7 weeks before Oskar Schindler was able to intervene to take the people on his list to the factory in Czechoslovakia. Tell me about that moment. How did you find out that you were able to leave Auschwitz?
Well, it was really interesting because we really didn't know what was going to happen to us. There was no way of knowing, you know, are we going to live forever? I mean, are we going to be in Auschwitz? Are we going to go? So actually, they were walking us in a group, you know, to be tattooed, when all of a sudden they told us to change direction. Oskar Schindler was there. He had brought in lots of money, a whole valise full of money, bribed the commandant, were shoved into boxcars. We were never tattooed. We're the only 300 women who have gone through Auschwitz without being tattooed. And if he hadn't come himself, I don't know what would have happened to us. But he came, took charge, and we ended up in the boxcars, and about a day and a half later, we ended up in Brinitz, which was the place where his factory was. The doors opened, we came out, and there was barbed wire, and behind the barbed wire were all the men standing, and that was the first time we knew that the men had made it, you know. They, of course, could not recognize us because when they last saw us, we had hair, we had our own clothes, you know, semi-our own clothes. But now we were all bedraggled after having been in Auschwitz such a long time, very emaciated, scarecrow-looking. But they were so delighted to have us there that it was quite a celebration almost. From the beginning, when we got to Oskar Schindler's factory, and the factory was supposed to be making V2 parts, you know, the rockets that were shelling London.
Yeah.
But Oskar Schindler decided that at that point that nothing from his factory was going to be of any use to the Wehrmacht, and so he told us to be sure to not do anything right, you know. As a matter of fact, the machines were calibrated in such a way that they were little off, and the calibrators that were supposed to measure the pieces were set up in such a way also that they showed that the pieces were correct, but they were not. Nothing ever left that factory to the V2 stations. So that was his sort of a revenge, too.
How long were you at the factory before the end of the war?
We were liberated on May 9th, 1945. So we were there from about end of November through that part of time. We felt very safe with him. He was very protective. He and his wife in particular was a wonderful human being. She foraged all around the farms for rutabagas and different winter vegetables that could be put into the water to make some sort of a soup. The problem was we were really, really hungry, and the rations were becoming smaller and smaller because it was very difficult to get food at that point. But she was great. At one point, I ended up in the infirmary, and it was Mrs. Schindler really who saved my life, because every morning at 10 o'clock, she would come into the infirmary with a pot of farina. You know what farina is?
It's a pasta,
like cream,
right?
Of wheat. Yeah, cream of wheat or something like that, that she had cooked herself, and then she would ladle it into our little bowls, and that extra little bit of nourishment was very, very important. You know, I was a growing girl. I was 13, so that was very important.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get to Iowa after liberation? I know that of course, a lot of people had to wait far longer than they should have had to go to a safe place and a safe home.
Well, after the liberation, you know, we ended up back in Poland, walking through Czechoslovakia, and we contacted the Red Cross to let people on the outside know that we had survived. We contacted a Jewish survivors organization to see if anybody from our families survived. And, of course, I had only had 2 second-grade education. I could read, but I certainly couldn't go into the gymnasium or, you know, the middle school or high school at that point because I couldn't write. I had not had a pencil in my hand in all those years. So we had to hire a tutor. And you'll probably want to know, how did we have money? Which was another thing that Oskar Schindler provided us with. Not with money, but each family was given 2 bowls of cloth because the factory that he took over was a cloth factory. We were given 2 bowls of cloth and 5 pairs of scissors, which he felt we could barter in Poland, you know, for a living, for food, for possibly a room, things like that. And boy, that really did help. We bartered all 4 pairs of scissors. I still have 1 pair, and I'm bringing it with me to Iowa.
Wow. Selina, there are so many things that I want to talk to you about, but we're going to run out of time. So I want to ask you, as someone who has spent so many years sharing her story, right now, at this moment in time, what does it mean to you to be able to share your story? Why is it so important to you?
Well, what's important to me is that I was the 2 years that I lived in Germany, I was really helped by my tutor, who was a 90-year-old retired nun who had never left the cloister. She, in her way, gentle way and total acceptance of me in teaching me German and English, showed me a way to work through my anger and bitterness, taught me that hatred is corrosive, and that the only way you can move forward is to work through your anger and hatred. And because of that, because of my encounter with her, I not only figured out that not all Germans were ogres, that circumstances make people do certain things, and that is why I speak to young people. I have an incredible faith in the young people. They are so much more acceptant of diversity. They are forward-looking. You know, you have to be taught to hate.
Of course, we saw neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville, Virginia, just a couple of weeks ago. And I know that you've seen the photograph of the young men in Creston, Iowa, dressed in white hoods.
Absolutely. And that shocked me, really shocked me, because I just never expected it in a high school, you know, especially not in the Midwest. Somehow, I'd always thought the Midwest had a different set of values, values of honoring people, accepting people. You know, we were the first family to move into, after the war, to move into Des Moines. And when I went to North High School, I was the only foreigner. And now Des Moines is a...
It's a cosmopolitan city.
Cosmopolitan city with all kinds of ethnic groups, all kinds of different looks, you know, and it's a pleasure to see that. So I was really surprised about Creston. I don't understand that at all.
It's not your job to tell us how to deal with that. But having seen that kind of hatred and what it can do to a society and what it can do to people, how would you like to see a community like Creston respond? How would you like all of us to respond when we see something like that?
Well, the only way is through education. There's no question about it. You know, I speak a lot at the Shoah Foundation. You know that after Steven Spielberg made the movie, mm-hmm. he took the $50 million, his take from the movie, his own personal take, and started the Shoah Foundation because there were people that came up to him when they were filming in Poland and telling him that they had a story to tell, too. So he decided to collect all of these stories before these people all died out. And in doing that, he collected stories from about 56,000 survivors in 30 different languages. And now all of those tapes and testimonies are available at something like 30 different places of higher education all over the world in various archives. And the beauty of it is that you can see, you can read about the Holocaust in books and magazines. You can go to museums and see all kinds of artifacts. But there is nothing that speaks to you more than a human voice. When a child who is trying to study about the Holocaust tunes into one of these people who are either hidden underground or hidden in a Catholic cemetery or hidden in a Catholic church, or, you know, that voice makes a connection. Yeah. And that is how, that's what I believe in. I believe in education. You've got to educate people to be good, because I think everybody has the potential of being good.
Well, Selina, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
Selina Karp-Biniaz, she is in Iowa this week sharing her story as a guest of the Iowa Jewish Historical Society. She survived the Holocaust. She grew up in Krakow, Poland, was forced into the Jewish ghetto with her mother and father, transferred to a labor camp, and then Oskar Schindler put their names on his list, and that's how they survived the war. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.